It was a wonderful weekend we spent in Springfield, Missouri. Saw all of our dear friends there. Had an absolutely exhilarating weekend, exhausting too. Monday and Tuesday of the following week, as I wasn't very much good at work because it's a long drive and you stay up late at night when you're visiting friends, and you know how it goes. And of course, in the morning we had a baptism, which was private because the gentleman involved didn't want an audience, and he had his reasons, and we respected that. So David Beckerdite and I were honored to do the baptism in David's backyard, and it was just all around a really, really good weekend. And 4 o'clock came, and that was the time that I had set that we had to leave because it was 6.5 or 7 hours back Sunday night drive. And as we hurried out the door, I forgot my briefcase. So I left everything that I'm used to there, and which is actually a good thing, because the subject that was planted in my mind since then has sort of taken root and germinated, and since I didn't have my natural things that I was used to in that little box, I've sort of had to go back into my library in the office and dig out a few things and read. And it's actually good because I actually pulled out some historical facts that I hadn't thought about or hadn't known before that I hope will be interesting today. So today I want to talk about, since it's actually summer tomorrow, the summer solstice, I want to talk about harvest today. In John 4, and we'll go back over this, we've already talked about this subject at one point in time, but there is a twist that I would like to talk about today. In John 4, Jesus meets the Samaritan woman. And we know the story, how that he was going from Jerusalem north, and he had two ways that he could go. He could go either go up the Jordan Valley, which would take longer, or he could cut up through Samaria, which was a shorter walk, and still make his trip, but a little less inviting because he was going through territory where he wasn't really wanted. Being a Jew going through a Samaritan land, they were foreigners after all, and which we're going to find out a little bit more about here in a minute. He still needed to make the time up, so he decided to go that direction, and of course he stopped at Jacob's well. He was thirsty, didn't have anything to pull up water with, and there was a Samaritan woman there. She had her pitcher and everything, and he asked her for water. Now, culturally speaking, that was a no-no, because Jewish men didn't talk to women, period. That was just the culture. Women were a sort of different breed in those days, not like today. They didn't get treated like they should be, how God made them to be treated, but man had his ways, and you didn't talk to a woman in that culture. Not only that, you didn't talk to a foreign woman. I mean, that was really taboo. She was, after all, a different nationality, and it wasn't seemly for a single man to talk to a woman. Just wasn't done. And here there's this conversation that takes place during the first part of the chapter. And throughout this conversation, Jesus starts telling her about her life, how many husbands, how many men that she's lived with, told her things that nobody would know, especially a stranger, that totally surprised her, took her aback, and made her realize that this man was somebody special. She even says, "You must be a prophet because you know all of this stuff." Well, at about that point in time, he had told her, "I am the Messiah," in verse 26. We come to what is considered in my Bible the whitened harvest. Verse 27 will break into the storyline here. At this point, the disciples came back because they had gone off to the city to buy food to eat because Jesus was hungry, not only thirsty, but he was also hungry. He was resting at the well, and he was waiting for his disciples to come back with the food. So the disciples marveled that he had talked with a woman. See, here's, again, this back up the culture. You don't talk to strangers. You don't talk to women. Men are somehow better than women in this culture. So they're sort of flabbergasted, and they didn't think to ask, "Well, what do you seek?" or "Why are you talking with her?" They're just surprised. So the woman then, at this point, she sees her chance. She leaves everything she's got at the well, and she takes off for town. She's going back to the town where she's from. She's on a mission, and we'll see that in just a second. Verse 28, the woman left with her water pot, went her way into the city, and said to the men, "Come, see a man who told me all things I ever did. Could this be the Christ?" See, this town, even though they're in Samaria, which is foreign to Jerusalem, they're looking for Christ. Odd. So then those that she had talked to, verse 30, came out of the city and came to Christ. Now I want to break off at this point and go visit a little history. If you'll turn very quickly to 2 Kings chapter 17, I want to read a little bit of history here. Because I had always thought when you read this story, you know, we know that the Israelites, or let's clarify it, we know that the house of Israel, the 10 tribes that lived north of the Jordan River, they all moved north to Samaria after Solomon's death when Jeroboam and Rehoboam split up the kingdoms. Jeroboam took that part of the nation north to Samaria. They found a mountaintop. They built a temple on it. And there they kept the Feast of Tabernacles in the eighth month. It's all recorded for us. And for 200 years, each king of Israel did evil in God's sight. Up to the point about 720 B.C., Assyria took Israel captive. And that's the point at where we're going to break into this story. Judah lasted a little while longer, about 100 years longer, before Babylon took them away captive. Now, to set the scene, if Jerusalem is down here, you've got the Mediterranean Sea, Jerusalem sitting down here. Nineveh is about 500 miles northeast. That's the capital of Assyria. 300 miles to their south is Babylon. Both cities are now in what's called Iraq. And that, of course, Babylon is at the confluence of the rivers where the Garden of Eden was. So you get an idea of the historical setting, of the geographical setting. So breaking into the story, let's notice. In chapter 17, verse 1, in the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah. Now, there's a dual story going here. So Ahaz is the king of Judah, the house of Judah. Hoshea, the son of Elah, and I may or may not pronounce these names right, became king of Israel. So the house of Israel, north, house of Judah, south, near Jerusalem. These two, this one nation split into two, and they're each sort of going their own way. Hoshea reigned in Samaria, and he reigned 9 years. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord, just like all the rest of them had. I think 19 kings or so. But not as the kings of Israel who were before him. And here's the reason why. Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, which is up in Nineveh, came against him. So here's an army coming against the house of Israel. And Hoshea, because he's weak and there's no army to defend the land, became his vassal. In other words, he's paying tribute to the king of Assyria so that they wouldn't be captured and taken away. Because that was what nations did. When Assyrians captured somebody, their whole idea was that they take the people in the land to a faraway land, and then they bring other people in and settle the land. That was, and we'll see all that here as we go through this little story real quick. So, Hoshea had paid the tribute. Verse 4. The king of Assyria then uncovered a conspiracy by Hoshea, for he had sent messengers to So, who was the king of Egypt. Hoshea has now made an alliance with So, and then did not pay tribute back to the king of Assyria. So, in other words, let's say that I make an alliance with somebody else so that if King 1 comes down, King 2 is going to protect me. That's what we have here. And we've seen that down through the ages. The United States make treaties with different nations that just in case there's a battle, so-and-so is going to come in and help us fight. Well, that's what they've done here. Well, it didn't quite work out like Hoshea had thought, because in the last part of verse 4, therefore, the king of Assyria shut him up and bound him in prison. He found out about the conspiracy, came in, captured him, put him in jail. Next, verse 5. The king of Assyria went throughout the land and went up to Samaria and besieged it 3 years. And in the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away to Assyria. So in other words, they went north and east approximately 500 miles with about 27,000 people. That's all there was of those 10 tribes. Imagine a nation in Solomon's day of about, give or take, 100 million in 200 years has now dwindled down to under 30,000. And for several years prior to this moment, there have been infiltrations from other people, other nations that have been sort of taking away the people. And all there is left is about 30,000 people. And these 30,000 people have now been captured, and they've been taken about 500 miles away. If you take 500 miles away, you disrupt a person's life, you put them in a strange land, they don't speak the language, they don't have any way of defending themselves, they're not part of the community, therefore you basically make them mute. They have no way of traveling, they can't come back to their land, they're defenseless, and that's how the Assyrians managed who they captured. So, he carried him away into Halma, which is directly north, to Haber by the river of Gozan, and into the city of the Medes. So, geographically, he takes them north and then spreads them east through Nineveh all the way into Asia, Asia Minor, which is where the Medes were. So you spread them out, you take away their identity, and you have subservient people. Now, let's go over to verse 24 to continue the story and see what else takes place. Because it really makes this story in John really interesting. Verse 24. Then the king of Assyria brought people from Babylon. Remember, Babylon is 300 miles south of Nineveh. He brought them in from Babylon, Cutha, Ava, Hamath, and from Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria. So now he's brought foreign peoples into the land. This is where it really gets fun. Instead of the children of Israel, and they took possession of Samaria and dwelt in the cities. Verse 25, and so it was at the beginning of their dwelling there that they did not fear the Lord. Really? Why would they? They're pagan peoples. Therefore, this is where, again, I think where it gets fun. Therefore, the Lord sent lions among them, which killed some of the people. Now, see, when you take a step back and you realize that it's God's plan, then you start figuring out that, oh, God can do what He wants to do. Here you have foreign peoples who are not of Israel, who don't know any of Israel's rituals. They've been brought 300 miles west and settled into a land and know nothing about God. And God finds them at fault and sends lions among them to kill them. Well, He got their attention. Look what they did in verse 26. So these same people spoke to the king of Assyria, saying, the nations whom you have removed and placed in the cities of Samaria do not know the rituals of the God of the land. So these foreign peoples in Babylon who have been brought over against their will and placed into this foreign land realize that there's a God of the land. Even though God is supposed to be in Jerusalem and put His name in Jerusalem. Now see, I find that a little weird. And yet this is God's humor maybe. So these people are finding out that God, there's a God there in that land, and they need to know the rituals of the God of the land. Therefore, He sent lions among them, and indeed they are killing because they don't know the rituals of the God of the land. So the king of Assyria replies, send there one of the priests whom you brought from there. Let him go and dwell there and teach them the rituals of the God of the land. Now wait a minute. The people that left didn't want to serve God. They moved away. They appointed themselves priests who weren't priests. And that's the one that's going to come back and teach? It just really gets kind of a little strange. And if you keep reading the story, the people that were there learned the rituals of God. They really didn't serve God, but they respected Him, even though they sort of inculcated all their own stuff into that religion. Sort of sounds like Catholicism today. That's kind of what happened. All the stuff that they did in their pagan life, they just brought with them. They feared God, but they did everything else that they were going to do normally. Sort of sounds just like what we have today. So, let's come back to this story in John 4. And notice what happens here. Because I think it shows God's interest in people, and it shows His humor too, I think. So, let's come back. Verse 28, the woman then leaves her water pot, goes into the city tells the people, come and see a man who told me all things that I ever did. Could this be the Christ? Then they went, all these people that she's come to get, come out of the city and come back to Jacob's well. In the meantime, of course, the disciples who have been down to go get food, they're kind of wondering what's going on. And they're urging Jesus, please eat, you're hungry. But in verse 32, here we go again, the humor. I have food to eat of which you do not know. See, here Jesus is on a different level. Even though he's human, he's fully spiritual and has the mind of God, and he's on a different plane than the people, and he's on a mission that they don't understand. I have food to eat of which you do not know. And the disciples are looking at one another. Somebody bring him something to eat? What's going on here? Jesus said in verse 32, my food, my meat, my job is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work. That had to be a strange saying to them, but let's follow the story. Verse 35, do you not say, and here culturally speaking, do you not say there are still 4 months and then comes the harvest? So we're probably right about now, before the harvest ends, before trumpet, so everybody can travel to Jerusalem. Behold, I say to you, lift up your eyes and look at the fields. What was coming to meet Jesus Christ? All the men of that city who were not Israelites, who knew nothing about God 700 years before, but who were excited to hear about Christ. Where did it all come from? Yet here is a harvest. And that's really the subject as we look at today. Let's finish up what we see here. Behold, I say to you, lift up your eyes and look at the fields, for they are already white for harvest. And he who reaps receives wages and gathers fruit for eternal life, that both he who sows and he who reaps may rejoice together. For in this is the saying is true, one sows and another reaps. I sent you to reap that for which you have not labored. Others have labored and you have entered into their labors. There is a principle here that we see in these last couple of verses. From the harvest come the laborers. If we think about, go a step back and look what Jesus did. He picked 12 men. They became his students. We call them disciples. After 3.5 years training on the first day of Pentecost in the New Testament, they became apostles. They became teachers. You notice Peter's sermon in Acts 1 and 2. Off the top of his head, with no notes, with no preparation time, it takes me weeks to prepare a sermon half the time, he comes off the top of his head with probably a 45-minute dissertation of history and facts and knowledge that brought 3,500 people or so, harvested them, and they were baptized that day. Imagine that. See, that's an example that we can look at that shows a man who was harvested out of a fishing boat became a teacher. All 12 of them. The 120 that were in the upper room all received the Holy Spirit. And by Acts 8, the 3,500 who were baptized the first day, perhaps multiplied by 2. Because if you read Acts 1 through 8, we're going to go to Acts 8 here in just a second. If you read through those chapters, you see that the church growed. It had power. People were sharing, unified, and the word was spreading. So perhaps there was 7,000 people. Let's go to Acts 8 and see what happens. Now Saul was consenting to Stephen's death. And at that time, a great persecution arose against the church, which was at Jerusalem. And they, perhaps all 7,000 of they, were scattered throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria. I love that. Except the 12. Now, what does that show? That shows that the 120 plus all those who had been baptized were now going back to their homes, perhaps, after a Pentecost of the magnitude that it was, and they began teaching as they went. They began preaching. They began proselyting. They began telling anybody who would listen about the wonders of God. Sort of, you wonder where we are today, why we aren't doing that, right? That's kind of what I get out of that. And yet, I think there's going to come a time when we all will do that. We're not under persecution. None of us have bled for the work. Not that I'm aware of. And yet, there's going to come a time, especially when you start looking at the book of Revelation, which at some point I may talk about that later, you start seeing 144,000 harvested. You start seeing a great multitude, innumerable harvested, standing before God on the sea of glass. That's a harvest, brethren. Today we rejoice over one baptized at Pentecost. When I dropped that man into the water, I felt like a giddy little kid. The Spirit was there. David and I could feel it. And it was a wonderful few minutes. Because it doesn't take long to baptize somebody and lay hands on them. But it was a powerful few minutes that I and David could feel the presence of God there with us. God was rejoicing because that person had come and been harvested out of the world. And given the training and the time, he may be able to teach others as well. That's what made our trip exhilarating for us. That was a rejoicing moment that David and I have that we can share and talk about in the future. David and I have become really good friends over the last few years, being able to serve down there. And there's a lot of interest that we have together that we bounce ideas off of each other. And some things I may talk about here later this summer, conversations that took place in their home led to ideas that have started spawning study just because the ideas bouncing back and forth and the iron sharpening iron because they were harvested and now they're laboring. And those labors pay off. Here's another man from up near St. Louis come all the way down to Springfield to be baptized, and he had to turn around and go back home. He couldn't stay for services. But that's one more person that's been harvested out of the world. Let's continue in this little story right here. Acts 8, verse 2. Devout men carried Stephen to his burial and made great lamentation over him. As for Saul, he made havoc with the church, entering every house and dragging off men and women, committing them to prison. Verse 4. Therefore, those who were scattered went everywhere preaching the word. Harvested becomes laborers. Philip went down into the city of Samaria and preached Christ to them. Oh, here comes Samaria again. Notice what happens. And the multitudes with one accord heeded the things spoken of by Philip, hearing and seeing the miracles which he did. Christ planted the seed in a woman's ears, didn't she? She went back and spread the seed to the people of the town. They came out to Christ, and through Philip's word, the harvest was made. You see how things go? We'll continue that theme here. After Paul was converted, shall we say harvested, he was taught by Christ 3 years in Arabia, and then he as well was sent to labor in the fields of the unbelieving. One of the biggest places that he went was Corinth. If you'll turn to 1 Corinthians, we will notice what he says here. Corinth was a fairly large city. It had a bustling commerce because it was sitting at crossroads of major travel routes so that travel could go north and south, east and west. Unfortunately, it had a degraded pagan culture, which you would normally think that would be the case because Christ wasn't there. So you have all these religions in place. You have people who are fairly wealthy. You have people who are very poor. This culture is just a mess. And there's religious idolatry everywhere. In the church, there were factions among the people. I can imagine why. If you have rich, they're going to congregate together and not really congregate with the poor. People seem to find their own point in the water where they want to float. There were lawsuits among brethren, which is what you would do in a pagan society. We have that today. There was immorality. We understand about the young man who had relations with his father's wife. There was problems at the Passover, Lord's Supper, as Paul called it. So there were all these things going on in the congregation. We'll catch up with things here in chapter 3, 1 Corinthians 3. You can imagine this, you know, this church has been established. You need to think it should be growing and people should be coming from the harvest. into the laborer side of things. And here's what Paul says. And I, brethren, could not speak to you as spiritual people, but as to carnal, babes in Christ. Mere babes, beginners, kindergartners, if you will. I fed you with milk and not with solid food until now. For until now you were not able to receive it, and even now you're still not able. So here's a group that had been established a while, and because of all these different things going on in the church, he's having to really come down on them for not growing past the harvesting stage. Verse 3, you're still carnal, for where there is envy, strife, divisions among you, are you not carnal men behaving like mere men, like what you used to be, pagans? For when one says, I am of Paul, the other says, I am of Apollos, aren't you carnal? And we've had that in the church too. You know, you can think back years before, I'm of Ron Dart, I'm of GTA, I'm of Fred Coulter, I'm of this guy, I'm of that guy, and there's people just split all over the place. And you go to Dallas-Fort Worth, where the area where we live, and there was, over 100 people there in the congregation that blew up in 98, and people are scattered all over the Metroplex and don't want to get together with anybody because they mistrust. They don't want to travel. They want somebody to come to them and speak in their home, but they don't want anybody else there. They don't want to share. That's why I decided I don't want to get involved with any of this stuff. I don't want to have to put up with all these people bickering at one another. I would rather travel and come to a fellowship group like this and enjoy myself. Because you people want to be here, and you people are unified. You people want to worship God and not nitpick each other. And that's where it's supposed to be. And here, these people, they're a sad lot, unfortunately. Notice verse 5. Who then is Paul and who then is Apollos? Just two people. They're ministers through whom you believed as the Lord gave each one. You have a pastor, Ron Elkins. He has a ministry. He speaks a certain way. He sounds a certain way. He waves his arms and does all the stuff he does, and you're used to him. I come in, I'm a guest speaker. I do things differently. And you hopefully enjoy me. And we have gotten to know one another. Next year, Helen and I have decided, Lord willing, and the creek don't rise, we're going to be in Wagner for the feast because we want to be with you all. Because we want to enjoy the company of brethren, not go to some site of 800 people where we know maybe 15 or 20 people. We want to know everybody. We want to as John said this morning, be part of the posse. Because we want to feel loved and wanted. And I'm able to serve. Helen's able to serve. And we're able to be with people who love us. And that's, to me, that's what the feast is all about. That's what service is all about. If I can make a difference. If you can make a difference in your life, that's what going from the harvest to the laborers means. We must make a difference. And Paul here is trying to make a difference in their lives as well. Verse 6. He says, I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. See, it's God's field. It's God's game. It's God's rules. It's God's plan. It's not Paul's plan, it's not Apollos' plan, it's not my plan. If it was my plan, I'd do things probably differently. But I'm a man, and I think like a man, and I'd make a mess. But just like God in John 4 brought those people to Jesus Christ who were not Israel, He's bringing these people to Christ who are not Israel, and they're believing and coming to God, just as we all have. And each one in their turn has to go from harvested to grow, to get fed, to become a laborer. Because in the end, we are all going to be ministers in the kingdom. What better time to learn how to be a minister is to do it now. And that's what Paul is trying to get across here. You can't be like you were. You can't be pagan. You can't live your old life. You have to grow in God's truth. You have to be able to read it, to understand it, and to follow it. That's the whole idea here. These people may not have been able to read. They had to listen. But they had to be able to memorize it and think about it and understand it that way so that they could take it into their daily lives. Verse 8, he who plants and he who waters are one. We're each separate people. Different people do different jobs. And each one will receive his own reward according to his own labor. For we are God's fellow workers. You, he says to the Corinthians, are God's field, are God's building. God is building a family. Foundation is Christ, chief cornerstone. The apostles are the foundation wall. And each of us in turn get put in place. And we all get fitted together. Each of us will have a job, should have a job now. Whether it's filming, making the coffee, setting up chairs, putting out booklets, kneeling down and praying for somebody who's an infirm person. All of those things are labor. All of those things are service. Not everyone can get up here and speak. For a long time, I didn't want to get up here either. I led music. That was enough for me. I'll let, you know, it is what it is now. But each person has their talents. Each person has their work. And that's what Paul is trying to get across here, that it needs to be done each in its own way. Case in point, go to Hebrews chapter 5. Hebrews 5. Now the book of Hebrews is written to Jewish converts to Christianity. And at this point in time, there was a lot of persecution in the Jewish community against these people who had converted to the way, which is what it was called back in the day. So now that they were experiencing all this persecution, many were having second thoughts and thinking about returning back to Judaism to avoid persecution. So we go to chapter 5, verse 12. The writer says, "For though by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you again the first principles from the oracles or the practices of God, and you have come to need milk and not solid food." In other words, they've gotten to a point in their growth, but now they've regressed. And that's a dangerous thing for a person, to grow and then pull back. The principle is once you've set your hand to the plow, don't look back. Well, that's what they're doing. They're turning around and looking back at what they left, thinking it's safer than what they're facing. Now, in the days that we live in now, and I think all of us are aware to some point, we are very fast approaching a point of no return in this country. Our government is going into socialism so fast, it's scary. And we face tumultuous times. But like these people, we may face persecution, but it's the wrong time to pull back. Notice what Paul says. "For everyone who partakes only of milk is unskilled in the word of righteousness, for he is still a babe. But solid food belongs to those who are full of age." They've become mature. They've been around a while. They've grown up to a point where now they're wanting to serve. They're wanting to pitch in and help. These people were thinking about, well, I don't think I want to do that anymore because it puts me in the limelight and I'm going to get persecuted for it. He says, that is, those by reason who use their senses, they're practicing their lifestyle, exercise to discern both good and evil. When you get to a certain point past the harvest where you want to be a laborer, theoretically, you should be full enough of age and mature so that you will be able to handle the persecution that's coming. That's what the writer's talking about here. And at some point, we all, and I mean we all, are going to face tough times. We may stand in front of a judge. We may have somebody knock on the door, kick it down, come into our basement and take us away, remove our Bibles from our homes. There's a lot of things that's going to take place if this is really the time of the end. And I think we're very, very close to that. Very close to that. So what we have to really understand and prove to ourselves is, are we going to stay bottle-fed, or are we going to enjoy some filet? That beautiful porterhouse. Chicken breast with the little stripes on it that the grill makes when you barbecue. Are we going to enjoy the fat and take our lumps with our heads held high? Or are we going to shrink back from our duty? Because we've all been called from the world. We've all been harvested out of the society. That's why we're here. So there's got to be a reason why we're here. There's got to be a reason why we're willing to take that chance. That risk will soon come to fruition. At this point in my notes, I sort of just drew a blank. And this morning, I had written down a couple things, and this morning I decided, you know, I'm going to go back to one of my favorite scriptures because I think it applies here. Ephesians 4. This is one of my most favorite scriptures. This and Romans 8 are probably my two most favorite passages in the Bible because it really shows what God's plan for us is. Romans 8 tells us that we are children of God. We're heirs with Jesus Christ of His kingdom. And Paul here talking to the Ephesians really puts it on the line in a loving way that we can understand. Ephesians 4 verse 1, I therefore the prisoner of the Lord beseech you to walk worthy of the calling which you were called. That's why we're here. We've been called out of the world. We've been harvested from the world and we're now being fed with all lowliness and gentleness, with long suffering, bearing with one another, just putting up with one another's foibles. If you're around me very, very long, you'd know I have foibles too. Helen's been with me for almost 32 years. She knows quite a few foibles. Enduring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. Wanting to be at peace with one another. Not having factions and divisions and lawsuits and all the things that the Corinthians did. There is one body and one Spirit, just as you were called in one hope of your calling. One Lord, one faith, one baptism. When we baptize, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, you're brought into the King, into the family of God. It's not into a denomination. There's no shingle on the door. You're in the family of God. You are a son of God. That's how Mr. Roach was baptized 3 weeks ago. Just like we do everybody else. It's God's calling, not mine. It's God's family. And that's what's important here. Notice down in verse 11. He Himself gave some to be apostles, those who were sent, the 12 plus Paul, some prophets, some evangelists, and there's been evangelists down through history, some pastors, some teachers. Why? Why has that structure been set up? Here's the answer. For the equipping of the saints for the work of ministry. What does that mean? It means so all of us can labor together for the good of the kingdom. Because that's what we're looking forward to. God's kingdom on this earth. Can you imagine what it's going to be like when we stand there as a spirit being on the earth and it's a mess? When all the infrastructure is wiped out and the people are ravaged and war is everywhere. And we can come and put our hands around somebody and say it's going to be okay. I represent a government that's going to be here for 1,000 years. You're not going to have to worry about war or famine or pestilence or hunger or thirst or weather or drugs or gang violence or anything of that nature. We're going to have peace for 1,000 years. I can guarantee it. That's what we get to say to people. Imagine that. And when God assigns us to our little places, we're going to get to go and set up our shop, if you will, and replace the infrastructure and set up the streets, rebuild the houses in preparation for people to come and live. And the little remnant that's left alive into the kingdom, we can comfort and we can teach. And as they have children, they're going to be brought up in a land free of all the stuff that we have to suffer through today. That's what I look forward to. That's what we represent. And that's what God wants us to labor toward now. Till we all come, verse 13, to the unity of the faith and the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect, mature man or woman, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, that we should no longer be tossed around to and fro as kids, carried about by every wind of doctrine, like the Hebrews who were now thinking about going back to Judaism because they were afraid of a little persecution. Now, I don't say that boastfully because I'm afraid too. I've hurt in my life. Some of you know about that. And it's not fun to hurt. But you know what? That's temporary compared to everlasting life. 1,000 years as a representative of God's government. And then whatever lies beyond that, when God brings the city down here to this earth, and there's a new heavens and a new earth and everlasting eternity. I have no way of understanding what that is yet because I have a finite mind. But when I'm there and when you're there, we will all understand how great that's going to be. That's what we represent. That's what Jesus wants us to look forward to. The joy of the kingdom for all of us. One more verse and I'll quit. Let's go to Hebrews 12. Hebrews 12 follows Hebrews 11, which is an accounting of history up to that point, which includes the several years that Nero ruled Rome, and a lot of the second half of the chapter is included in that. People being sawn asunder, burned alive. All of that took place in Nero's time, and possibly beyond, before that too, when the prophets were slaughtered. But Hebrews 12 says this, verse 1 and 2. Therefore, we also, we that sit in this little room and people like us all over the globe today, we are surrounded by all the witnesses of the past. Let us now lay aside the weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us. And I'm just as bad as anybody else with that. And let us run with endurance, patience, measuring our steps, learning and growing through exercise. It's amazing what exercise will do. I went through 3 weeks of physical therapy for my back, and you know what? My back got stronger because I was doing exercises to strengthen that part of my body. Exercise works. And in this case, exercise works just as well too. Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Whatever our labors are, let us do them willingly, because we have been harvested from the world. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before Him. What's His joy? What was set before Him? He's the King. He's number one. He gets everything and He's willing to share it with us. Who for the joy that was set before them, Him, endured the cross, despised the shame, and has now sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. In the not too distant future, we well may be able to sit there with Him as well. Think about that. Can you get around what it might be like to be a spirit being in the presence of Jesus Christ and God, our spiritual Father? Through here we get just the tiniest glimpse of the glory that's there. And yet we're going to share that with Him for eternity. Brethren, let's run our race. Let's live our life to the Lord and labor till we can labor no more, because the harvest is ready.